At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Say this for Ben Bernanke. He is one prompt son of a gun. Sat down right on time today to get his big press conference going.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at CarbonitePro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday. It's the 27th of April today.
In my opening remarks, I'd like to briefly first review today's policy decision. I'll then turn next to the Federal Open Market Committee's quarterly economic projections, also being released today, and I'll place today's policy decision in the context of the committee's projections and the Federal Reserve's statutory mandate to foster maximum employment and price stability.
Yeah, he went on like that for about 11 minutes. The Fed's first ever press conference almost expired of boredom before things picked up. But as always happens when Bernanke speaks, on Capitol Hill mostly, the good bits came in answers to questions, this time from reporters. There was much talk of inflation in the Fed's bond buying program, which is going to end in June. Gas prices, about which Mr. Bernanke admitted he can do nothing. He'd like to see unemployment lower, and he wants Congress to do something real about the debt and deficit for a change. And at the end, there was a longish but pretty human answer to the question of what's taken so long for things to get back to normal.
The combination of high unemployment, high gas prices, and high foreclosure rates is a terrible combination. A lot of people are having a very tough time. So I can certainly understand why people are impatient. And I guess the only thing I can say is that while the recovery process looks likely to continue to be a relatively moderate one compared to the depth of the recession, I do think that the pace will pick up over time, and I am very confident that in the long run that the U.S. will return to being the most productive, one of the fastest growing and dynamic economies in the world.
As I said, longish, but interesting. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale was at the Fed this afternoon. Hi, John.
Hey, Kai.
So after that slow start, the slow statement reading that he did, talk to me about substance. What did he say?
Well, he's really worried about the slowing recovery, I think. The Fed has pulled back its growth forecast for this year pretty significantly and raised the rate of inflation, at least for the short term. Bernanke's not concerned about inflation long term. He kept saying it's only transitory, it's due to demand for commodities in developing countries and unrest in the Middle East. And that includes gas prices. He's not worried about them continuing to rise at their recent pace. He's more optimistic about unemployment coming down more quickly than last projected in January. But that, too, is only short term. Over the next 3 years, the Fed's forecast is that unemployment's going to be higher than 6.8% through 2013. But I think Chairman Bernanke and the Fed members are more concerned about a sputtering recovery than they are about rising inflation.
What about, then, the prospect of interest rate increases? He did give us some sense of timing, right?
Right. He explained what extended period means, which is what the Fed's been using for several years now. That means that it'll be a couple of Fed meetings, which gives markets at least a 3-month warning before rates will go up.
What about the atmospherics, John? This was, as everybody out there has said, an historic press conference, never been done before. What was it like?
I think there was a sense that we were breaking some new ground in terms of communicating Fed policy. Reporters were on their best behavior. even though, you know, the head of the European Central Bank's been holding routine press conferences for 10 years or so, Bernanke was a little stiff at the beginning, but he quickly settled into, you know, he's a professor. It was like a seminar on inflation and supply and demand and unemployment and the limits of monetary policy.
He did say, though, that, I mean, this was a conscious decision and he's going to keep on doing it.
He's long advocated for a more open Fed. That's a big contrast to the past, when the Fed used to shroud its decisions in mystery. It's sort of like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. Bernanke thinks that a more open Fed will mean fewer surprises and less volatile markets. Of course, the risk is that an inadvertent misstatement could send markets or economies into a tailspin.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, our Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale, today on the Fed meeting. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Wall Street didn't necessarily love the Fed statement and the press conference today. Didn't hate them either. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The world's biggest aerospace company reported stellar profits this morning. Boeing says earnings rose 13% in the first quarter. But the skies aren't entirely clear. Last week, the National Labor Relations Board filed a complaint against the company over questions of work practices. Sounds fairly bureaucratic, but it could represent a new direction in labor law in this country. And commentator David Frum says we all ought to be paying attention.
Let's go to the bottom line. The National Labor Relations Board's headline-making complaint against Boeing for investing in South Carolina is almost certainly going nowhere. The complaint involves Boeing's decision to expand production of its 787 Dreamliner aircraft in South Carolina rather than in Washington. Boeing's union and the NLRB allege that the decision to expand in South Carolina amounts to illegal retaliation for past strike activity by Boeing unions. The NLRB has in the past acted against companies that close one location after a strike in order to open another. But it is unprecedented for the NLRB to act against a company that, like Boeing, maintains existing production but expands somewhere else. The NLRB has never before attempted to assert authority over investment and expansion decisions. For that reason, it's generally believed by labor lawyers that Boeing will prevail, and probably sooner rather than later. The South Carolina congressional delegation is enraged by the NLRB's action against Boeing's expansion in their state. Senator Lindsey Graham points out that one of the Boeing board members who voted for the South Carolina expansion was William Daley, now President Obama's chief of staff. Is the Obama administration suggesting that its own chief of staff engaged in illegal anti-union retaliation? But the issue here is not South Carolina. The issue is, what does the NLRB think it is doing by attempting to reinvent labor law in this radical way? Perhaps the NLRB hopes that by administrative action, they can somehow hold the line against outsourcing and thus compel American corporations to place investment in the future where investment went in the past. If so, those hopes are worse than futile. They represent a tragic distraction from the challenge of sustaining middle-class incomes in a globalized era. The NLRB's high-handed actions will achieve nothing but enriching Boeing's lawyers on the way to the inevitable outcome.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next Wednesday, Robert Reich is up in the rotation. But in the meanwhile, send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Here's today's quiz from the Marketplace desk of Situational Ethics. Which do you suppose is worse? The fact that hackers managed to steal personal data from 77 million online accounts attached to Sony's PlayStation network, or that Sony took almost a week to let those 77 million people know that hackers had stolen personal data from their PlayStation accounts? The company did shut down the network a week ago, but why the delay in telling people about it? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
Sony may have a lot of reasons for not telling gamers about the data breach right away. Maybe the extent of it wasn't clear, or Sony didn't want to cause widespread panic. But intentionally or not, delaying the bad news may have saved Sony money. Research from a tech think tank shows companies that respond quickly spend 54% more cleaning up their PR messes. Tim Matthews is with Symantec, which sponsored the study.
If organizations respond too quickly and actually notify people who, in fact, were not affected, customers are equally likely to get upset about it and then take their business elsewhere.
Josh Shaul did a double take when he read the Symantec study. Shaul is with Application Security, which makes database security software. But he says when you think about it, delaying the bad news makes sense.
Having to go out with a message like all your credit card data may have been lost, we really don't know, is pretty painful, particularly if in the end that credit card data was never accessed.
So delay can pay. But is that why Sony waited so long to break the bad news? Danny Sullivan doesn't think so. He edits SearchEngineLand.com.
To think, well, if we wait a week, then we're going to save money. Do you wait 2 weeks and you save more money? Or it's so complicated, I just don't see how they would have calculated that sort of thing.
Sullivan thinks Sony upset more people by waiting. Sony officials haven't had much to say, and they didn't respond to my numerous requests for comment. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
While this is, in fact, a news program, I feel no obligation at all to let you know that the much-awaited royal wedding is just 48 hours away. I figure we're off the hook because, A, really? And B, pretty much every other news organization in the known universe is keeping track. The William and Kate extravaganza is expected to draw maybe 2 billion viewers worldwide, and based on the coverage so far, almost as many journalists, which will require a fairly hefty return on investment for those media companies. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The networks have been waiting for the big day since Wills popped the question.
100 days until the big royal wedding.
It's now 4 days, 9 hours, 3 minutes, 14 seconds or so.
All right, 3 days to go until Britain's royal wedding. Can we skip this story?
No, says media consultant Sherry Ann Brill.
When everyone else is going to be there, you can't not be there.
CNN will have 125 journalists on the ground. Fox is sending 50. NBC's broadcasting the Today Show from London. Even Al Jazeera's on it. There are reports the networks are spending up to $10 million each to cover the event. And that's in a year when shrinking news budgets have already been squeezed by the natural disaster in Japan and uprisings in the Middle East. Still, Brill says the wedding is actually coming at a good time.
It's manna from heaven for the networks, especially because this is the all-important sweeps measurement period.
Networks use data on viewership during sweeps to set ad prices. The wedding also gives networks a chance to promote their other shows and build loyalty among an increasingly fragmented audience. Toby Miller is a media professor at the University of California, Riverside.
It's about showing that this is the natural home for viewing big events.
For Americans, though, it's likely to be a big event for their DVRs. The coverage kicks off at 4 a.m. on the East Coast. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you look historically, you know, visual analysis, facial recognition has been kind of a supercomputer function that's only done on servers.
Spying. Yeah, there's an app for that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 95 points today, about 0.75%, closed at 12,690. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, also 0.75%, 2869 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 0.6%, finished at 1355. Amazon rose 7.8% today. Johnson & Johnson gained 1%. General Electric clicked up 2.7% today. CEO Jeff Immelt told shareholders that the future looks bright. The dollar dropped again, and that's in investors to commodities. Gold struck another record high, settled at 1512 an ounce. That's 1512 an ounce. Silver buffed up to $47 an ounce. Oil settled at more than $112 a barrel. Ben Bernanke and his presser said today the Fed is going to hold steady on interest rates, as we mentioned, so bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.35%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its Advance Estimate Gross Domestic Product Report for the first quarter. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly Pending Home Sales Index for March. And students from across the country are in D.C. to recite poetry. 53 champions compete in the national finals of Poetry Out Loud. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Libyan rebels got a big win today. Diplomatic, though, not military. The Obama administration has decided the Transitional National Council that the rebels set up is a political body that should have U.S. support. Support, not full diplomatic recognition just quite yet. Libya is still a long way from a political or a diplomatic solution, but Egypt, right next door, has already voted on rules for the presidential campaign that's going
from
to be
held in the fall. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events
Egyptian
coming
experience
up Wednesday.
With elections under
in Washington,
Mubarak,
the Commerce
really
Department
the
releases data
free,
on durable goods
fair.
Orders for
oh,
March.
So over the next couple of
President
months,
Obama
candidates
and
voters
First Lady
there
Michelle
are
Obama
to
are in
learn.
Chicago taping an episode
as we
of
look
the
at
Oprah
how American
Winfrey
businesses might
and
fit
Ebert
into the new
Fest
economic
gets underway
system
in
Marketplace's David
Gura
reports on the U.S. contribution
by none other than critic Roger Ebert himself. I'm
a few weeks ago, Egyptians voted on changes to their constitution that paved the way to new elections. Harvard public policy professor Tariq Masood followed it closely, and it got him thinking.
How are you actually going to organize the electoral process? How are you going to make sure that when people go and vote, they have the ability to vote and they believe that their vote will actually be reflected in the final vote tally?
Those are questions Ken Feltman has wrestled with for decades. He's a political consultant who's worked with candidates around the world.
I want to know, what do the voters want? What are they saying? What do the people want?
In the U.S., candidates have relied on outside help for years to do research and polling and to develop strategies and ad campaigns. It didn't take long, Feltman says, before political consulting became another American export.
We were the large democracy, and therefore we were supposed to know how to do things.
Today, election consulting is an international industry, headquartered in Washington, but with hubs in France and Argentina. There's reliable work in Europe and Latin America, and now there are new prospects in the Middle East and North Africa, including Egypt.
There are many people trying to get in and be hired, and they've run over thinking that their briefcase is their credentials. The people doing the hiring don't know what's on their checklist.
Part of the reason is that for the first time, Egyptians will get a chance to vote in an election where the outcome hasn't been decided in advance. Consultant Ben Goddard is open to working for a campaign, but he knows there will be challenges.
Egypt has never had elections. Where are you going to find an Egyptian who knows how to run a campaign?
Goddard has been in politics for almost five decades. He says his mission is always the same: to persuade people to a certain point of view and to make them express that point of view at the polls.
Now, the way it's executed needs to be adapted for the culture of each individual nation.
Goddard says he picks clients carefully. Nothing is more valuable to a consultant than his reputation and his record.
You know, nobody wants to take on a for sure loser, but then usually a for sure loser isn't going to be able to afford us anyway, so oftentimes that just sorts itself out.
Political consultants work on contract. They can charge hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on how much they're doing and where they're working. But in some places, Goddard says, they're lucky to get paid anything.
Well, one of the things you learn very early in international consulting is that you get the money up front.
There are opportunities for consultants to work for Egyptian campaigns, but Professor Tariq Masood says there are also risks.
I think that any political candidate who gets on the phone and hires, you know, James Carville, and if that became known, that would severely limit their appeal and credibility and popularity with the Egyptian population.
Consultants say that in their line of work, confidentiality is key. And as Ben Goddard puts it, their goal is to stay as invisible as possible. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, education abroad, American colleges in the Middle East. It's Wednesday, that time of the week again.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The debate over the debt ceiling is on temporary hiatus thanks to the congressional spring recess. But our commentator Amity Schlaes weighed in this week with a historical perspective. Calvin Coolidge and how he ran a surplus while managing to cut spending and taxes. A lot of you wrote to say, wait a second, this guy left office in 1929. The phrase Great Depression mean anything to you guys? Here's Brian Werner of Kansas City, Missouri.
This is like claiming that a pilot has a clean record because he jumped out of the plane before it crashed.
But Jonathan Lovelace of Milan, Michigan, came to the defense of the 30th president.
It was Hoover's interventions, attempts to limit the damage and stimulate a recovery, that made what could have been a minor recession a depression. And then Roosevelt's programs kept it going until the war. Coolidge's hands-off policies might have started the downturn, but Hoover's, and especially Roosevelt's, hands-on policies made it into the Great Depression.
Last week was a year since the BP oil spill in the Gulf Coast. Beth Larson of Washington, D.C., listened to commentator and chef Susan Spicer reflect on what has changed for her since then. Larson says she enjoyed her visit to Spicer's New Orleans restaurant, but she senses a contradiction in the chef's views on how the U.S. responded to the spill.
On the one hand, she praised national agencies for testing food and making her customers confident of its safety. On the other hand, she said she was disappointed in the government response. So now I'm disappointed that this world-class chef turns out to be so typical in her misunderstanding of what her national government actually does for her.
Let us know what we can do for you. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. We mentioned electronic privacy earlier, Sony trying to deal with 77 million PlayStation accounts being hacked. But here's the thing. The way the high-tech economy works, with gadgets getting cheaper even as they're getting more sophisticated, maybe it's not Big Brother we ought to be worrying about at all. If the prospect of pretty much anybody being able to get their hands on the electronic version of you is an issue, Little Brother may be more of a problem. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Cafe Vita in Seattle is a pretty typical techie coffee shop. Music, caffeine-soaked coders, and lots of open laptops. Eric Butler fits right in. He's the creator of FireSheep. It's a browser plugin that makes hacking so easy, even my mom could do it.
Basically, all you have to do is click a big start button, and then it will start listening on the network.
Pictures and names pop up on a bar along the left-hand side of the browser, and anyone surfing the same wireless network you're on is suddenly vulnerable.
For example, Facebook, if you FireSheep will display the name and show the picture of other people in the room who are using that site. And if you double-click on that person, it will allow you to actually log in as them.
You could send messages to their ex, post photos, do anything you want. FireSheep's been downloaded more than 1.3 million times. Butler says he wrote it to make a point about how vulnerable we all are. Now he's building a smartphone app that will let users read trip data off strangers' transit cards right through their wallets. Paul Sapho's a futurist and the managing director at Discern Analytics.
We worry about Big Brother and this world of ubiquitous sensors and geolocation and augmented reality is wonderful stuff for Big Brother. The real surprise is that it enables Little Brother.
Consider a company called FlexiSpy. It lets customers surreptitiously load its software onto the phones of their frenemies, acquaintances, or family members, then start spying, listening in on conversations, even track people with GPS. And if that's too much trouble, you can even buy your own malicious cell phone tower.
So that you can intercept, you know, the voice, transmissions, SMS, even data.
That's Don Bailey, a security consultant at ISEC Partners.
It used to cost tens of thousands of dollars, but no longer. Today you can pick one up for about $1,200.
And all sorts of other technologies that were recently the province of spy agencies are becoming commonplace. Facial recognition, drones, and tiny sensors have become toys. Jason Matur is the chief technology officer at a Palo Alto startup called Viewtl.
If you look historically, you know, visual analysis, facial recognition has been kind of a supercomputer function that's only done on servers.
Viewtl software does facial recognition on cell phones in real time.
We're not going to help you recognize people that you don't already know. We're not going into the hold it up to a random stranger at a bar and, you know, find out who they are.
But Ryan Kalo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford Law School, says as these technologies become more common and affordable, abuse is almost inevitable.
I can tell you that there will be use cases that will bother you.
He says, imagine for a second you're the editor of a tabloid or a suspicious spouse.
Why wouldn't you want to have a drone that flew around L.A. looking for Brad Pitt?
Or your cheating spouse.
If you have facial recognition technology and you have a drone with autonomous functioning.
And Kalo's serious. There's a 2-foot-wide drone on the market today you can buy for a couple $100s. It can record streaming video and send it to your phone. In fact, I own one. And a little while ago, Kalo and I took it out for a test flight on Stanford's campus. But before we could gun the engines and start shooting video of random law students, we had to click through the disclaimer.
Obey all laws and respect the privacy of others. That's yes. Great. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no problem then.
Yeah, that's right. We're all covered. It's all good.
In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a nifty little counterpoint to all the grim privacy-related technology news of late. On this day in 1981, the first mouse meant to be used with a personal computer went to the market. It was attached to a Xerox Star workstation. 30 years later, that particular computer is no longer with us, but the mouse endures. Didn't really become popular, though, until the Apple Macintosh hit the market back in 1984. And, you know, they did all right, right? Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 95 points, 0.75% on the day Ben Bernanke gave his first press conference ever. The NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 added 8.6%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, American colleges in the Middle East making big investments up front.
We will give you a full scholarship. We will even fly you in to have a look at our campus. We'll pay for your accommodation. We'll pay for your food.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.